I think that the fantasy of Fight Island has, I don't want it to eclipse the reality of Fight Island. I think people have this idea of tiki torches and, you know, me sitting on some huge throne watching the fights.
When UFC president Dana White first brought up the idea of Fight Island, it sounded like a pipe dream. But now it's actually happening. Today, Ariel Helwani tells us how we got here and why the island is far from the tropical paradise some envisioned. Then, he explains why some of the UFC's biggest fighters are starting to push back. I'm Mina Kimes. It's Thursday, June 11th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by Marathon. Ariel, before we begin, can we agree that if this was called Fight Suburb, people would not be nearly as excited?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Fight Island is one of the all-time great marketing ploys by the UFC. It sounds fun and sexy, and I can explain why that is. But I, as a guy who's a proud, you know, suburb resident right now, I'm down with that, but I don't think the fight fans would be.
Ariel Helwani has covered mixed martial arts for more than a decade and hosts the podcast Ariel Helwani's MMA Show. So let's start with this big announcement. UFC fans got great news. What did UFC President Dana White reveal this week?
Okay, so he revealed on First Take on Tuesday morning that they will be holding four events in July, starting with the July 11th show, UFC 251. At this quote-unquote Fight Island.
Everybody has been dying to find out where Fight Island is. So today I'm here to announce that Fight Island is on Yas Island in Abu Dhabi.
It's not the first time they hold events at Yas Island. They've actually been there three times before. I was there back in 2010 for UFC 112, their first event there. Yas Island is sort of this man-made island, but really looks like a desert. And this place where there's all kinds of attractions and theme parks, there's a Ferrari world, all that stuff. But it's not going to look like everyone thought it was going to look.
I feel like everyone's excited because we've all been playing Animal Crossing during the quarantine. And we're just dreaming of this beautiful tropical island where UFC is planting down. But it sounds a little bit more like Staten Island.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I've been to Staten Island as well. Not very good pizza over on Yas Island, but it's an amazing place because they're basically creating this bubble, this safe zone, as they're calling it, where all the UFC competitors, all the staff, all the coaches will live in this hotel. They'll have their own training facility, their own restaurants, and no one else will be allowed to enter this safe zone, as they're referring it to. And also what's interesting is that the fights are actually going to happen, at least for UFC 251 on July 11th. They're going to happen in the middle of the night to cater to the North American fans. So the main card, which usually starts here in America at 10 p.m. Eastern, is going to happen at 6 a.m. local time in Abu Dhabi Sunday morning. So the fighters are going to have to stay on the American clock and not adapt. And that could be really interesting to see how it plays out.
We should acknowledge the fact UFC, unlike many other sports, Ariel, has not been on hold. There have been live fights since May 9th. So they've been going on for more than a month now. Why were they able to do that, whereas other sports were not?
Okay, well, there's a few reasons. Number one, Dana White, the president of the UFC, was very, very confident that this should continue, that his sports organization should continue and not shut down.
These guys are ready to go. They want to fight. They want to compete. And we're going to do everything we can to keep them safe.
He's also very good friends with the president of the United States, Donald Trump. And he was a part of conversations with President Trump about not taking a break and about continuing to forge on. And he was very confident from the get-go.
I talked to the president and the vice president of the United States today about this, and they're taking this very serious, you know, and they're saying, be cautious, be careful, but live your life and stop panicking. And instead of panicking, we're actually getting out there and working with doctors and health officials and the government to figure out how we keep the sport safe and how we can continue to put on events.
In fact, he didn't even want to stop. Like when this all happened in mid-March, he fought very hard to try and keep the train rolling along.
These fights will happen. We're going to move on. These fights will happen. These guys will compete. We will find venues and we will figure this thing out.
The main reason why they are able to put on these events and the other major leagues aren't, quite simply, is there's no Fighters Association. There's no union. Dana doesn't have to answer to anyone else. As long as he can get 24 or so fighters to agree to fight on a card, he's good to go. He's the judge and jury. The buck stops with him and it starts with him as well. And so he doesn't have to deal with a board of governors. He doesn't have to negotiate. He doesn't have to deal with the Players Association. There's no collective bargaining. And that's why you see pro wrestling continuing to go on. That's why you see MMA. That's why you see boxing return this week. What do they all have in common? There's no association. There's no revenue sharing. There's no none of that. And so they don't have to deal with all the issues that baseball and basketball and hockey have had to deal with.
Of course, you've been watching and covering these fights that have been happening already in a so-called bubble, a few in Florida, and now at the Apex Arena in Las Vegas, which UFC owns. How are they different from the normal pre-pandemic UFC fights?
The main difference, obviously, is there are no fans in attendance.
Welcome into a weird atmosphere tonight, man.
Super weird, but man, it's nice to be back.
Yeah, it's insane, man. I know there's no fans. It's weird we get to hear every single punch land.
Although I would say that the product hasn't suffered at all. We're actually programmed as MMA fans to watch fights without fans in attendance for two reasons. Number one, the UFC had a reality show called The Ultimate Fighter for 15 years.
On this season of The Ultimate Fighter.
Yeah, I'm on edge. I'm not saying to nobody, and I'm cooking my food. Next question.
It was basically a concept where the fighters lived in a house, and then, you know, they were in this tournament, and they would fight in this basic, it was like a warehouse type of situation.
Okay, pound, 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 pound. You got him. Finish him now. You got to work.
There would be no one in attendance there, and we watched that for 15 years, and those were high-level fights.
The riot is about to happen. Relax. Everybody back off and relax. I'm like, what?
Also, if you've ever been to an event in, say, Las Vegas, which usually starts at around 3 o'clock local time, 6 o'clock on the East Coast, and everyone's still out, you know, at the pool doing their thing, and it's a late arriving crowd. I mean, I've been to many Vegas shows, many California shows, where there's probably no more than 50 people in a massive arena for the early fights, right?
Whoa, boy, swinging wild.
Man, he's throwing big.
So we're accustomed. It's not like an NBA game that when it starts, there's 15,000, 16,000 people going crazy. We're accustomed to fights happening in front of very small crowds. It has been really fun because in the midst of the fights, you can hear the cornermen shouting instructions.
Junior's there all the way, especially on that side. The junior's there.
Step off and shoot that right after.
You can hear all the chatter. You can hear the punches, the kicks, the knees, the elbows, a lot better than when there's 18,000 people yelling.
Oh, man!
Stung him with that left hand.
And in fact, multiple times, the winning fighter has said, thank you very much, fight analyst sitting cage side. It's often been Daniel Cormier sitting cage side saying, thank you for your analysis during my fight because I heard what you were saying about what I was doing wrong and I listened to you and I adjusted as a result of that. So thank you.
And I even heard Cormier saying, she needs to mix her takedowns and her striking. I'm like, okay, mix them in, go for some fakes. Like, I definitely heard it and tried to use it to my advantage.
That's just a wild set of circumstances that we would never see. So in all, it's actually been kind of fun and different.
I love that detail about the fighters, hearing the analysts giving advice. So Fight Island, I cannot say Fight Island without laughing, Eric. Fight Island has been rumored for a while, right? And there were some alternate ideas thrown around. At one point, there was talk of trying to hold an event in April on Native American land that didn't happen, Florida. How did Fight Island go from rumor to reality?
So the last UFC event you know, in the old days, so to speak, back in March, was on March 14th in Brazil. The next UFC event after that was scheduled for March 21st in London, England. And Dana wanted to continue to go on. He did not want to stop. He was on SportsCenter saying, no, we're going to have the event in London and we're going to have our next one in Columbus, Ohio, March 28th, et cetera, et cetera. Eventually, of course, you know, the real world caught up to him and he realized that that was going to be really hard. So one of the first interviews that he did was tell the world that, hey, we're going to figure this out sooner rather than later. We're going to be one of the first sporting organizations in America to get back up and running.
I'm going to continue to pump fights out. I've also secured an island. I've got an island. The infrastructure is being built right now. We're going to do all of our international fights on this island.
I think that he was just kind of throwing it out there and then it caught on and everyone loved it. Everyone loved talking about it and dreaming about it. Abu Dhabi had long been rumored to be the location for quote unquote Fight Island because they have a long-standing relationship with the Abu Dhabi government. Back in 2010, the Abu Dhabi government actually bought 10% of the UFC and they eventually sold it when the company was sold back in 2016. When you have a relationship like that with the government, it's very easy to get things done.
Other than the fact that it is not the tropical paradise that some of us have been envisioning, what else do we know about Yas Island and why the event is being held there?
So it's going to be basically like a UFC island in many respects because, as Dana White said yesterday, they're pretty much controlling a radius of 10 miles where no one else can come in. It's going to be at this sort of empty, it looks more like a hangar to me, but the fights aren't going to be outdoors like they were back in April of 2010 when I was there because, you know, it's over 100 degrees in July over there. So that would be crazy. Now, Dana says that there is going to be a cage on the beach for training and maybe for aesthetic purposes, but no actual fights will be taking place on a beach.
Fight hangar just doesn't have the same ring. No, they just doesn't roll off the
tongue. They did a great job. They've been selling t-shirts for like a month and a half now. If you go to UFC.com, you can buy a multitude of Fight Island swag, if you will. It's pretty impressive what they've done here from a marketing perspective.
So the first actual fight at Fight Island is UFC 251, July 11th. What do we need to know about this card?
All right, it's a really good card. There's three title fights on the card. The main event is for the welterweight title, Kamaru Usman versus Gilbert Burns. The co-main event is Alexander Volkanovski versus Max Holloway 2. That's for the featherweight title. And the third title fight on the card is an interesting fight for the vacant bantamweight title, the 135-pound title, between Pyotr Yan, the Siberian gangster, who's a great up-and-coming fighter, against the former featherweight champion, who's moving down to 135, Jose Aldo. So on paper, in a vacuum, it's a really good card, and there's a lot to like there. There's one part about it that kind of gnaws at me a little bit, because
the main event should have been Kamaru Usman versus Jorge Masvidal, almost like a cult-like figure in our sport after 18 years in the game. It's the fight everyone wanted to see. Unfortunately, they couldn't come to terms with Jorge, so they are giving the fight to a guy named Gilbert Burns, who's a solid contender who has done really well this year.
It bums a lot of people out, including myself, that they weren't able to make that happen because Jorge deserves that fight, and it had been a long time coming for him.
Well, on that note, after the break, let's talk about Jorge and some of the tensions brewing right now between the UFC and its fighters. Hi, guys. Given everything that is happening in the world right now, most of us are buying things online. I saw that AT&T started doing two really helpful things for those who want to buy a new phone or device online. They are offering fast, free, non-contact delivery and curbside pickup so that online shopping is as simple and safe as possible. On top of that, they have a flexible return policy so you can shop at ease. You can visit att.com to learn how to shop online from the safety of your home 24/7. Subject to change, restrictions apply. Ariel, unlike many other sports, the UFC has brought back live events and quickly restarted its fights in the midst of the pandemic. There was an incident where a fighter and his team tested positive for coronavirus and had to be taken off the card. And some outside medical experts have been critical of the UFC resuming fights and its health protocols. But inside the UFC, how do people feel it's going? What have you heard from fighters?
all the fighters are very happy, especially the UFC fighters, because there are other fighters in MMA, right? There are fighters who fight for Bellator, owned by Viacom, won championship in Asia, and none of them are able to fight right now. So a lot of them are getting jealous that the UFC fighters are getting this opportunity. What they're doing for these events in Las Vegas is you check in, you take a COVID-19 test via the throat, and then you have to self-isolate for about 24 hours until they get the results of that test. Once they get the results of that test, you can go out and train and do your thing. Then you weigh in on Friday morning. Then you have to take a second COVID-19 test via the throat. And then you have to stay in your hotel room for the entire night leading up to Saturday, into Saturday afternoon when it's time to go to the actual event. I have to give a lot of credit to the Nevada State Athletic Commission, who is overseeing this and being very strict. They're making everyone social distance, wear the masks, all that stuff. In fact, Dana White said that he didn't want to wear a mask and they didn't allow him to sit cage side. This is the owner of the company and he had to sit in the back because for whatever reason, he didn't want to wear a mask. Now, when they go to Abu Dhabi, there is no athletic commission there, so they're going to self-regulate. I suspect that they will do it like they've been doing in Nevada with the two tests leading up to the fight. And if you want to nitpick, you could say, all right, there should probably be a third test after the fight, right? To make sure that everyone, once they go back into the real world, is healthy and tested negative. But they're not doing that right now. The fighters aren't complaining about it. They think that the two tests are enough.
So the fighters are largely okay with the health side of this, but they're not all okay with the money side. Some top fighters, Jorge Masvidal, who we mentioned earlier, John Jones, who you and I have talked about on this podcast, have come forward and said they're not fighting, citing various issues with how much UFC is willing to pay them. Ariel, is this dissent a product of the moment and perhaps shrinking revenue? Or is it something that's been brewing for a while?
Definitely something that's been brewing for a while. The UFC's response maybe is a product of the moment, but Jorge Masvidal isn't speaking out because of the pandemic. Neither is John Jones. Conor McGregor isn't frustrated because of the pandemic. And Henry Cejudo, who retired last month as well, isn't walking away because of the pandemic. The common denominator here is money. And they all want more money. They all want to get paid more. And this has been a very hot topic in our sport for, over a decade. Historically, what happens is fighters get upset. They'll speak out here and there. The UFC will eventually come to terms. They'll stay quiet and they'll move along their merry way. In this particular case, because you have multiple fighters speaking out, a lot of people in the industry are thinking, is this going to be the time that the fighters come together and actually form a union, an association, form some kind of collective voice? I don't think that will happen because all their gripes are very different. They're not all coming together and saying, you know, we're upset and we're forming some kind of association/union. A lot of them don't feel comfortable doing so, but it has been shining a light on the fact that the fighters don't make as much as they probably should. And the UFC, is saying, hey, we're in the midst of a pandemic right now. We're not making money off ticket sales. We have no gate revenue. This isn't the time to be playing hardball and asking for more money.
Ariel, as you mentioned, this has been a discussion, right, around the UFC for a long time. The Athletic recently surveyed 170 fighters across various MMA promotions, including UFC fighters, and more than 75% of them said they wanted a union. But as you laid out, there is a discrepancy between the stars and the rank and file. What would it take for the sport to unionize?
It's very complex because I view the UFC roster like a four-tiered system, if you will. There's the top tier, the very top, which really only includes Conor McGregor and Khabib Nurmagomedov, who are making tens of millions of dollars. And their stance typically is like, hey, you know, I'm up here, I made it, I'm living good. Then you have the next tier where it's the other champions in the UFC. You know, the guys who are doing pretty well, they're making millions of dollars, but not like Conor and Khabib, the John Joneses of the world, the Daniel Cormiers of the world. And, you know, they're living pretty well as well. And you have to understand, like, the grind to get to that point is absolutely brutal, right? You're like, you're starting off living in gyms, sleeping on mats, and then you're slowly working your way up. Then you have the third tier, the contenders who are saying to themselves, like, wow, I made it this far. I'm on the verge of becoming a champion. Hopefully soon I'll get seven-figure paydays. This isn't the time to ruffle feathers. And then you have the guys who are just entering the UFC who are making $10,000 to show and $10,000 to win. And they're definitely not speaking up because, you know, they don't have a leg to stand on. According to documents that we've read and also multiple media reports, you know, the fighters are making 12 to 18% of the total revenue as opposed to in the NBA where they're making 50%. They're not making any money off the TV deals. Now, I speak to them privately and they all say, yeah, I would love to change X, Y, and Z. And yeah, I'm very frustrated. But when it comes time to actually speak out together as a collective, they rarely do it.
And there's no other true buyer for their services.
If we are talking about like from a notoriety standpoint or a competition standpoint, no, there's no one on the level of the UFC. I mean, it's akin to, I don't know, the NFL and the CFL. But if someone like Jon Jones entered free agency, I can guarantee you that Viacom, who owns Bellator or one of these other organizations overseas, would overpay to get his services because he's such a big name. Conor McGregor as well. I mean, Conor is the one guy who could probably put on his own event like a Floyd Mayweather and do really well as well. But it's come to a point right now where, you know, there are other people out there who would probably overpay for that top 1 or 2%.
So speaking of Conor McGregor, he announced over the weekend that he's retiring again for, I believe, the third time. Yes. I'm reluctant to talk about this because I'll just say it. I find it very hard to believe, and I don't think I'm alone.
Yeah, I agree with you in that regard. A lot of people are very skeptical of this. A lot of people are saying, okay, Conor, first of all, why did you have to do it on Saturday night? Why'd you have to do it right after Amanda Nunes won her fight? The timing was a little annoying to these people. And unlike those first two times that he did it via Twitter, this one's a little different because, luckily for me, he spoke to me that night and he expanded on his feelings and thoughts. And he's just a very frustrated guy who wants to fight, who basically told us at the end of last year, hey, I've turned my life around. 2019 was a mess. It was very much a year to forget. But in 2020, I'm going to fight three times. I'm going to get back to where I was. I'm going to be the champion. I have lofty goals. And the year couldn't have started out better. He wins that fight in January against Donald Cerrone in 40 seconds. He's on fire again. This past, you know, a few months, he's been donating millions of dollars worth of medical equipment to hospitals in Ireland. And so he's healthy. He's ready to go. And he's saying, I can't get a fight. You guys aren't giving me a fight. And the UFC isn't necessarily saying this, but part of the reason why they're not too keen on doing a fight right now for him is when he fights, the ticket sales are like $15 to $18 million. So they're going to lose a lot of money if they put on a Conor McGregor fight. Now, you can make a case that they'll make a lot of money from a pay-per-view standpoint because there's not a lot going on right now, but it's just a little challenging. Do I think he'll come back? Yes. I think that we need to ignore the R word and pay attention to what he's really saying, which is, I'm healthy. I'm ready to go. I'm in a good place. I want to fight. Can you figure this out and get me a fight?
Ariel, what has it been like for you covering UFC these days?
It's been really interesting. Thanks for asking. I appreciate that. you know, I've been doing it from home. I've been watching the events and, you know, I kind of started my career. Actually, I started my career sitting at the same table that I'm sitting at right now, reaching out to fighters via MySpace back in 2006, asking them to do interviews with me that I could post on my personal website. And it's kind of crazy to be back doing the same thing here. At this same table, reaching out to fighters via Zoom and doing interviews with them before and after these fights. But like I said, you know, you adapt. I had a great time in Abu Dhabi. It was a great experience, but I don't think that any of us are going to be going there. There's some nice parts about, you know, get to do a little radio from home, sit in my shorts, wearing shorts in my room, watch TV. I mean, it could be worse. I can't complain. I'm happy that I have something to talk about and not, you know, like my bud Jeff Passan, who every day just seems like he's talking about 79 games and 82 games. I feel like my head is going to explode listening to him. I'm happy I can actually talk about, you know, actual fight drama, which never gets old.
And also, I think dropped the first MySpace reference on ESPN Daily.
That's right. Yes. MySpace was very good to me back in the day.
Well, Ariel, you would be in my top 8. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Coming up, NASCAR makes history by finally shedding its past. We're presented by Marathon. Now more than ever, we have to look out for each other and count on each other. And Marathon wants you to know that you can count on them for high-quality, top-tier gas. While we're aware travel may not be top of mind, there might be times where you have to hop into the car to run an errand. Or maybe you just want to drive to see your best friend, simply to wave from a safe distance. But before you head out, remember to fuel up at Marathon. And right now, you can get 5 cents off every gallon every day with Make It Count rewards from Marathon. Plus, you can earn points for additional savings on fuel, airfare, hotels, and more. This is definitely a deal you can count on. It's also quick and easy to join. Just download the free Make It Count app or go to makeitcount.com/radio and start saving today. This offer is valid only at participating Marathon stations. Remember, wherever you need to go, the people at Marathon are behind you all the way. Marathon, fueling the American spirit. Here's another story I want you to know. Last night, NASCAR announced via a statement that it will now prohibit the display of the Confederate flag at all events and properties going forward. This comes after the sport's only full-time black driver, Bubba Wallace, called for the racing body to ban the flag earlier this week.
You read some of the comments of people won't come to races of African-American descent. They won't come to races simply because the Confederate flag is flying. The African-American community does not feel welcome. And I think we can help that by removing Confederate flags. If it bothers them, then let's make that change.
I asked our Ryan McGee to join the show and discuss this huge news. Ryan joins us from his truck. Ryan, what was your first reaction to this?
My first reaction was finally. And then my second reaction was to take a deep breath and realize that I didn't believe I would ever see this in my lifetime. You know, it was just a few years ago after the church shooting in Charleston, South Carolina, and the debate that happened with the Confederate flag flying over the state house in Columbia, South Carolina. And when NASCAR then said, anyone in the infield who brings us their Confederate flag will happily exchange that for an American flag or the flag of their favorite driver or a NASCAR logoed flag. And I thought that's as far as they'd ever take it. That was about as much of a punt as I thought we could ever hope for. And so when I saw that release drop on Wednesday, I had a hard time processing it. And then it was just relief because now I don't have to defend myself anymore about loving the sport.
What do you think was the tipping point?
The tipping point was Bubba Wallace. You know, we're now going to enter the self-congratulatory phase where a lot of people within the sport are going to say, well, you know, this was in the works. And this. Listen, at the end of the day, Bubba Wallace, who if you were so kind as to read my ESPN The Magazine feature on Bubba 2.5 years ago, you know, he pledged to be a person who dedicated himself to changing people's perception of what NASCAR was and educating the world on what the NASCAR garage is versus what people think it was based on 1968. And so he, in the worst of times, in the middle of this racial strife and this the protests and the arguments that are happening all over the country, Bubba Wallace saw an opportunity, and that was to move the glacier. And he, when we look back 20 years from now, he'll be the person that did that.
It's one thing for NASCAR to say, all right, no more Confederate flags, no more T-shirts. It's another to enforce it. Is it even possible?
Oh, it's possible. And that's the part that, you know, as soon as I tweeted out on Wednesday the announcement from NASCAR, the immediate response from some of my more vociferous Southern followers was, you know, you can't enforce that. Yeah, you can. You know, I worked for NASCAR. I was on the payroll for a couple of years, and I was on helicopters with the licensing people. And they were flying around. I mean, listen, Daytona, Talladega, the California Speedway, these are racetracks. I can't even explain to you how huge these sports facilities are. They dwarf every NFL stadium. And they got on helicopters, and I've ridden with them, where they have gotten those military binoculars out and said, that guy down there is selling illegal, unlicensed stuff. And next thing I knew, I mean, there were vans rolling up, and they were taking their stuff away. And so they can 100% enforce it if they want to. I'm curious to see how that goes. I'm curious to see how many fans decide to try to make a stand on this once the fans do finally return to the racetrack. But yeah, no one out there should kid themselves that NASCAR can't enforce it because they 100% can.
Ryan, you said you never thought you'd see this. Why is that?
bold moves have never been NASCAR style. They've been great at statements. They've been great at this is how we feel and we're not who you think we are. The sanctioning body's always had so much power. They've always had so many great people in that office, and I know where their hearts are. And so the question was, would they ever have the guts enough to take a stand on what I knew they already believed in, even if there might be a corporation or two that said, don't do this, even if there might be a driver or two who were reluctant to take a stand? The sanctioning body finally did it, and I, for one, am very thankful for it.
Thanks so much, Ryan.
Thank you, Mina Kimes.
I'm Mina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.